but they were seen as different from each other by people at the time. And then you have Irish, which is related to British and Pictish, but much more distantly. Finally, there was the language of the Angles, which we could roughly call English, which is a Germanic language, quite different from the Celtic languages. You could also add a fifth language, namely Latin, which is the language of the Christian Church. Christianity was making great inroads in this period, especially in the British-speaking areas of what is now southwestern Scotland. But let's return for a moment to the Picts. There are many unresolved questions about the Picts. We're not sure, for instance, whether the Picts lived only in Scotland or whether there were Picts in Northern Ireland as well. There are hints that there may have been Picts in Ireland at around this time, because there are signs that there was a people in Ireland, especially in the north, who were regarded by the Irish as ethnically distinct from them. These people were called the Cruthin. Now, the term Cruthin is etymologically equivalent to a word that is used to describe the Picts, with one interesting and perhaps telling difference. At the beginning of the word, where you would expect a P, you get a C, so Cruthin rather than Pruthin or some such form. This is exactly the difference between the Q Celtic languages and the P Celtic languages that we talked about in an earlier lecture. So the Cruthin in Northern Ireland may very well be the cousins of the Picts in Scotland. Now, not all scholars are convinced that there was a genuine ethnic connection between the two peoples. But the bottom line, I think, is that we should see the boundaries at this period as very fluid. The sea is more of a highway than a barrier, and there is a lot of traffic across the Irish Sea. But Northern Britain is also very strongly connected to the rest of the island of Britain. It is not cut off by Hadrian's Wall, either before or after the Romans withdrew their legions. And the connection between Northern Britain and the south also survived the Anglo-Saxon conquests that I'll talk about in a future lecture. Just as the very famous figure of St. Patrick can exemplify the ties between Northern Britain and Ireland, so another famous figure can tell us something about how Northern Britain is tied to Southern Britain, namely King Arthur. There is a very early poem in Welsh called The Gododdin that takes place in what is now Scotland, and it's probably most famous today because it contains the first mention of a warrior named Arthur. It takes place around 600, during the period when the Angles were pushing north into what had been British territory in southeastern Scotland. The poem depicts a raid by the men of the British kingdom of Gododdin on the Anglian fortress of Cattraeth, which ended in a disastrous defeat for the Britons. Now, the poem was about the north, but we only have it because it was preserved in a manuscript far to the south, in Wales. Ultimately, British speech disappeared in Scotland. It was squeezed out in the southeast by the Angles and in the west by the Irish. And ultimately, British was replaced everywhere on the island of Britain except in Wales and Cornwall. British was the ancestor of both Welsh and Cornish. But in Wales, they clung to the memory of a time when people who spoke their language had ruled in the north. The Welsh referred to this period as Arhenogledd, or the Old North. I think it's quite poignant that the Welsh preserved this memory of former greatness. The story of the Celts is full of this kind of nostalgia. So what does this poem actually say about Arthur? It's a very cryptic reference, but we can get something out of it, I think. The poem praises one of the warriors of the Gododdin, a man named Gwarðir, for his mighty deeds in the raid on the Anglian fortress of Cattraeth. Here's how it reads. He fed black ravens on the rampart of a fortress, though he was no Arthur. So what does it mean that he fed black ravens on the rampart? It means that he killed a lot of guys who became food for the ravens. But there's a sting in it. Yeah, pretty good, but not as good as Arthur. This is actually our earliest reference to someone named Arthur having a huge military reputation. Arthur is clearly the gold standard against which this other guy, Guardiar, is being measured. I'll say much more about the story of Arthur in a future lecture, but for now I just wanted to make the point that this one little reference to Arthur can show us how connected the whole island of Britain remained, even in a period of tremendous political change and upheaval. But now back to the Picts. If the story of the British in the north is largely one of retrenchment and defeat as the areas of British speech were slowly squeezed out, then the story of the Picts is very different. With the Picts, we see political consolidation, even what we might call triumph, at least for a few brief but glorious centuries. Before we tell the story of the rise of the Pictish kingdom, I want to fulfill my promise to say more about the Pictish language, where exactly it was spoken, and where it came from in the first place. Both of these questions are hard to answer. We don't know as much as we would like to about Pictish, because we have only a few inscriptions to go on, and these tend to be concentrated in the north and east of what is now Scotland. So we imagine that that was the heart of Pictish-speaking territory. But we can't be sure of that, since we don't have inscriptions from the rest of Scotland in other languages at this time, so we might be seeing a distribution of inscriptions rather than a distribution of a language. What we may be seeing is that the area of inscriptions corresponds to the area where a Pictish dynasty was able to establish political control. More about that in a minute. But this could understate the amount of territory where Pictish was the main language of the people. So if you look at a supposed map of where Pictish was spoken, take it with a grain of salt. We're not really all that sure. But the question of where exactly Pictish was spoken has been less controversial than the question of where it comes from. There have been various theories about the origins of Pictish, and keep in mind that all of these theories have to be based on a very small number of words, largely personal names, which is not at all ideal for trying to reconstruct a language. One theory suggested that Pictish was related to Irish, while another suggested it might even be related to English. These theories have been discounted by modern linguists. They just don't hold up to linguistic scrutiny. The weirdest theory, but potentially the most intriguing one, is that Pictish might be a pre-Indo-European language that had somehow survived the supposed arrival of the Celts in northern Britain. This theory has the merit of making the Picts seem incredibly cool, like some sort of special remnant of a very deep prehistoric past. But it's just not true. Linguists and historians have now pretty much agreed that Pictish is a Celtic language closely related to Gaulish, though they're not exactly sure how distinct it was from British, and they can't be sure whether it became distinct from British while both languages were evolving on the island of Britain, or if the two languages, Pictish and British, made their way to Britain independently. Thus, we're back to the question we discussed in a previous lecture of how the Celtic languages got to Britain in the first place. Unfortunately, in the state of our current knowledge, we really can't be sure. If you were to try to draw a map of the languages of northern Britain in, say, 600 AD, it's hard to say whether you would want a very hard and fast line between Pictish and British, or whether it would be more of a continuum than a hard and fast line. But at any rate, Pictish was perceived as a separate language by observers at the time. And since it died out in the 10th or 11th century, we will never be able to test the proposition thoroughly. The reason we understand this linguistic relationship at all is because we do have some inscriptions, as I've said. Some Pictish inscriptions use the Latin alphabet, but other inscriptions use a totally different system of writing called Ogham. Ogham probably comes from Ireland, where it is fairly widespread from the 4th to the 6th centuries, but you also see it in various parts of Western Britain and in Scotland. It's a system of writing that uses a center line as the base, and then lines come out from the center line to form the various letters. It's sort of like an early medieval barcode. Irish Ogham typically uses the edge of a standing stone as the center line, whereas Pictish Ogham often has a line cut into the face of the stone. Now, most of these stones are memorial markers of some kind. We get mostly personal names, X, son of Y, etc. but these inscriptions have provided enough evidence to help settle the language question we've been talking about, in favor of Pictish being a pre-Celtic language very similar to British. There is one more mystery about the Picts that we really don't have a solution to. That is the meaning of the so-called Pictish picture stones. These stones feature repeating motifs that are common to the whole area of Pictish inscriptions, so they seem to belong to some kind of standardized pictorial vocabulary or formulary, but nobody knows what they represent. Modern scholars have given these symbols names such as the double disc and the Z-rod, but they don't really know what they represent. The really weird one is the so-called Pictish beast. It doesn't seem to represent any known animal. It looks a little like a seahorse or possibly a dolphin, but it's hard to tell. Some people have even proposed that it depicts the Loch Ness Monster. Scholars are working on these images even as we speak, so we can stay tuned for further developments. For now, though, we can say that with the exception of the Pictish beast, the Picts are less mysterious than we used to think. They grew out of the same political and cultural developments as we see in the rest of Britain. They are not some weird remnant of a pre-Celtic past. They are as much Celts as anyone else in Britain, which is to say, they're definitely speaking a Celtic language, though nobody is calling them Celts at the time. So I said that the Picts were a success story. How so? Well, the Picts seem to have gotten their act together and created a fairly stable, unified kingdom, which was always quite an achievement in this period. Starting in the period around the fall of Rome, several Pictish kingdoms emerged, primarily in northern and eastern Scotland. And a 10th century document called the Pictish Chronicle says that there were seven of these kingdoms, each ruled by one of the seven sons of a single king. This is suspiciously cut and dried, but it does express the reality that the Picts were slowly cohering. And by the 7th century, the most powerful Pictish kingdom, the Kingdom of Fortru in northeastern Scotland, probably exercised a kind of hegemony over the smaller Pictish territories. But the Picts were also very open to outside influences. They apparently patronized Irish-speaking bards, which foreshadows the ultimate replacement of Pictish language and culture by Irish in the years to come. But for now, I think the takeaway from this exploration of northern Britain is that the later Kingdom of Scotland is probably the most diverse in origin of any of the so-called Celtic regions. It develops out of a mixture of British and Pictish and Irish and English elements. And we'll see later that Scotland gets even more multi-ethnic in the Viking period when we add people from Scandinavia into the mix.
Lecture 9, Prehistoric Ireland and the Celts.
Welcome back. So far in this course, we have mostly been talking about the Celts on the European continent and the island of Britain. But in this lecture, we'll focus on Ireland. And Ireland will, of course, play a very important role in the course from this point on. There's a lot to say about the early history of Ireland, but in this lecture, I'm going to focus on a single question. How did Ireland wind up as a Celtic-speaking country? It clearly was by the time it enters the historical record. I'm going to answer the question in three ways that correspond to three different moments in time. First, we'll look at what the early Irish themselves thought they knew about their own prehistoric past. How did they become the Irish? We'll see their very intriguing and complicated national traditions on display. Second, we'll examine what modern scholars have made of these traditions. How have they thought about the question of the peopling of Ireland? And finally, we'll briefly look at some recent changes in how scholars understand early Irish history. We'll see that the answers to these questions differ substantially. Our picture of how Ireland became Celtic is quite different from what earlier generations of scholars believed. Some of these changes in our understanding of Celtic Ireland come from sources we're very familiar with by now, archaeological evidence and DNA analysis. But a lot of the changes in our views of Irish history have to do with changing interpretations of a very important text about early Ireland called the Book of Invasions. It's the origin story of the Irish people, and I'll spend most of the lecture today describing it and talking about how scholars have interpreted it. Before I start digging into the Book of Invasions, though, I want to make two important points about Ireland. The first point is this. In contrast to Britain and the continent, Ireland was never conquered by the Romans. In all the other areas where people spoke Celtic languages, except for the far north of Britain, the Celtic experience was dramatically shaped by the encounter with the Roman Empire. In some areas, such as Switzerland, the Romans almost entirely wiped out any trace of the language and culture of the Celtic speakers. In other places, like Britain, Celtic speech survived, even if it was under pressure from Latin. But Ireland was different. It never experienced Roman rule. In a famous incident, the great Roman general Agricola, whom we have met before when he was suppressing British rebels in the period after the Great Revolt of Boudica in the 60s AD, looked across the Irish Sea at Ireland and said, effectively, we could take it if we wanted to. But they never did. And that meant that Ireland went through a lot of crucial developments without the direct influence of Rome. There were no Roman ruins in Ireland, no Roman road system. The Irish developed pretty much as they wanted to, without the experience of cultural imperialism that inevitably followed in the wake of the Roman legions. The second preliminary point I want to make about Ireland follows from the first. Because Ireland was not conquered by Rome, Irish society was not literate until the conversion to Christianity, which got started in the late 4th century, but it didn't take hold enough to produce lots of written texts until several centuries later. So it's one thing to say that the Irish kept their own traditions while the rest of the Celtic world was succumbing to Roman domination. It's another thing entirely to know exactly what those traditions were. So how do we know anything about pre-Christian Ireland? Mostly, we have to rely on texts written down after the conversion to Christianity. Fortunately, there are a lot of these texts. Ireland can boast not just the largest body of vernacular texts in a Celtic language, but in fact the largest body of texts to survive in any vernacular language from early medieval Europe. These texts come in all varieties. There is a lot of legal material because the Irish were extremely litigious. There's also a lot of genealogical material. In a society where claims to property were determined by family relationships, it was important to be able to tell who was related to whom. There's also an extensive body of texts that we would broadly consider literary, though they have elements of history and mythology mixed in. And the text I'm going to talk about today, the Book of Invasions, falls in that category. So we actually have quite a few texts that can give us a picture of the pre-Christian past. There is a problem with these sources, though, and I've already said what it is. It's the very fact that all of these texts were written down after the conversion. We can't date them precisely, because some of them clearly refer to pre-conversion times, but how much they have been altered after the fact is hard to tell. Scholars are engaged in a great debate about how we can use these sources, and we'll get to that a little bit later in this lecture. For now, though, it's time to get to the text itself, so we can see what the early Irish thought they knew about their own past. This is the first moment in time when we'll look at the question of how Ireland came to be Celtic, each time through the lens of the same early Irish text. The main origin legend of the Irish, the story that explains how Ireland came to be populated, is called the Leabhar Gabhála Éireann, which literally translates as the Book of the Takings of Ireland, but it's usually just called the Book of Invasions. According to this text, Ireland was populated by a series of invasions or takings by a whole series of different invaders, six waves of invasion in all. The text began to take shape starting in the 8th century, but we have it in versions that really crystallized in the 11th and 12th centuries. It is very, very difficult, and it must be said, not a page-turner, at least to the modern reader. It's confusing and hard to read. A lot of what is in the text is mainly about place names and genealogies. How did this lake or that plain get its name? Who is descended from whom? All fascinating to the original audience. But however much the medieval Irish loved it, it's pretty tough sledding to us. Furthermore, almost every part of the story is told both in prose and in poetry, and the two versions often conflict. It looks very much as if someone started out with a prose version and a poetry version and spliced them together without going back to get rid of the inconsistencies. So now that I've really whetted your appetite, here's how it goes, in what I can assure you is a simplified version. Ireland was uninhabited until 40 days before the Great Flood, when Kesar, the daughter of Bith, son of Noah, appeared on the island with 50 maidens and 3 men, seeking refuge from the coming flood. But to no avail, because 40 days later they were all swept away by the rising waters, and Ireland was uninhabited again for the next 300 years. Of course, it's unclear how we know all this, but some versions of the story say that one of the 3 men was a poet named Fintan, who somehow survived the flood and passed on the tale. The details of how this happened are a little vague. So anyway, the next peoples to inhabit Ireland were a series of groups all descended from a different son of Noah named Japhet. The first were the followers of a guy called Partholone, a 7th generation descendant of Japhet, who arrived in Ireland on a Tuesday, we learn, which happened to be the 14th of the month. And I love the fact that the text provides that detail. But the Partholonians, as they were called, did not enjoy their prize unmolested for long, for soon thereafter a group of one-armed, one-legged, giant pirates appeared, called the Fomorians, and a battle ensued. The first battle ever fought in Ireland was won by the Partholonians against the giants. Things didn't go well for the victors, though, since a plague soon came and killed them all, except for one who survived to tell the tale in the time of St. Columba in the 6th century. And I think you can tell here that the compiler of the text is struggling hard with the question of plausibility. You're probably starting to wonder if we're ever going to people this island at all. But the uninhabited phases are getting shorter. This time, just 30 years later, another group shows up. These are the followers of Nemed, a 10th generation descendant of Japhet, who came to Ireland by ship from the Caspian Sea, which was a pretty impressive feat of navigation under pre-modern conditions. The Nemedians still had to deal with some renewed attacks from the Fomorians, and after Nemed himself died of the plague, the Nemedians were cruelly oppressed by the Fomorian giants, who were somehow still around. The Nemedians had to hand over 2/3 of their wheat and their milk, and even their offspring, to the giants. Finally, the Nemedians had had enough, and they rebelled under the leadership of 3 chieftains. There was an enormous battle, which led to yet another island-clearing cataclysm. The sea swallowed everyone up, except for 1 Fomorian ship. Presumably this allows for a potential sequel where we can bring the giants back into the story. And 1 Nemedian ship, with 30 warriors on board. These 30 warriors soon split into 3 groups. 1 group goes to the northern islands, and we will hear more about them in a moment. 1 group goes to Britain, which conveniently makes the Irish the ancestors of the British. Ponder that for a moment. And the 3rd group goes to, wait for it, Greece. We are now up to our 4th invasion, which is actually a sort of homecoming. For the descendants of the group of Nemedians that had gone to Greece show up again 230 years later. They had not had a good time in Greece. They were oppressed there too, just as they had been in Ireland under the Fomorians. The Greeks made them carry soil in bags from the tops of mountains down to make level the plains below. Because of the bags they had to use in their work, they were called the firbolg, which literally means bagmen in Irish. So when the firbolg got tired of carrying bags of dirt, they decided to flee. So they used the bags, which were probably made of skins of some kind, to make boats and sailed off to find their ancestral homeland. So back they sailed from Greece across the Mediterranean to Ireland. But once again, they did not enjoy possession of Ireland for long. Here comes invasion number 5. Remember, when the Numidians left Ireland, some of them went to Greece and some went to the Northern Islands. The ones who went to the Northern Islands apparently spent their time learning magic and knowledge and sorcery and cunning. They too decided to come back to their ancestral homeland, so they invaded Ireland in a supernatural cloud of darkness, challenged the Firbolg to battle, and defeated them. And these newcomers were called the Tuatha De Danann, the peoples of the goddess Danu. The Tuatha De Danann were an impressive lot. Both men and women practiced various crafts, and some clearly had the aspects of gods, such as Ogma, the patron of learning and writing. Ogma is actually depicted on the door of the Adams Building at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. And he earns his place there because he was the legendary inventor of the Irish system of writing known as Ogham, which was supposedly named after him. And it's interesting that Ogma is seen opposite the Cherokee chief Sequoia, who actually did invent an alphabet for the Cherokee language. There is also Nuadu Argetlav, Nuadu of the Silver Hand, who lost an arm in the battle with the Firbolg. The healer, Dian Kecht, made him a replacement arm of silver with joints that really worked, very much like Luke Skywalker after his fight with Darth Vader. So Ireland is now being ruled by a magical people with all sorts of supernatural powers. But not for long. Get ready for the 6th and final invasion. It turns out that there were other people around who were wandering the world looking for a permanent home. This time, descendants of Japhet in the 4th generation. That is to say, they are more closely related to Noah than the Partholonians or the Numidians. Now I have to warn you. This is where it gets even weirder. This new group of Japhet's descendants had ended up in the Middle East, where their progenitor, Nail, was born at the Tower of Babel. He was then sent for by Pharaoh and married Pharaoh's daughter, Scotta. And this is supposedly why the Irish are called Scots. Nail and Scotta had a son named Goidel Glas, who was a very talented linguist. He took the 72 languages from the Tower of Babel, combined them all together, and made a new language called Gaelic, or Irish. And believe me, Irish looks like it could have been made from 72 languages. But in the context of the story, this is supposed to be a compliment. Things were about to get politically difficult in Egypt, though, because Pharaoh ran afoul of a guy named Moses. So after Pharaoh died in the Red Sea, the Gaels, as they became known, went into exile and took to the sea. See the pattern? This episode was apparently very important in the tradition associated with this text. There is a wonderful 15th century Scottish illustrated manuscript depicting the voyage of the Gaels, as we may now call them, out of Egypt. And notice I said it's a Scottish manuscript. This story is also an important origin story for the Scots, who you will remember came originally from Ireland. More on that in a later lecture. So the Gaels wandered around the Mediterranean for many years in search of a permanent home. Along the way, they encountered mermaids, whose call was so enticing that they had to stuff their ears with wax to avoid being drawn in by their dangerous charms. After wandering for 300 years, they landed in Spain and conquered it. And their leader, a man named Mil, ruled over Spain. They built a tall tower, a very tall tower, as we'll see in a moment. After Mil died, his sons Ever and Erivon ruled in his place. One day, their uncle Eith, who was a very learned man, went to the top of the tower and thought he could see, way off in the distance, the shadow of a land far away. He told his nephews, Ever and Erevon, that he would like to visit that land, so he set off with some companions. When he got to that land, which turned out to be Ireland, of course, he found the ruling Tuatha De Danann in the midst of an internal quarrel over property. Seeing that Aoife was a wise man, the contending parties asked Aoife for his judgment on the case. He essentially told them, "This is a beautiful, rich country, and there's enough here for everyone. Why are you quarreling?" Instead of making them feel better, this got them to thinking that Aoife was planning to invade and settle there, so they killed him. When the survivors of the expedition got back to Spain, Aoife's nephews were outraged and decided to avenge their uncle, so they set off for Ireland in their turn. Now, the Tuatha were pretty tricky customers, so they enveloped Ireland in a sort of cloaking device so that the Sons of Meal ended up sailing around Ireland three times before finally landing on Thursday the 17th. They went to Tara and demanded one of three things: battle, or kingship, or judgment. In the negotiations, the Tuatha agreed that the Sons of Meal would rule Ireland henceforth if they could first sail over nine waves and then return. This seemed like a good deal, so the Gaels got in their ships and sailed away. But of course, it was a trick. The crafty Tuatha called up a supernatural wind that sent up huge waves. Luckily, Ever and Erevon had another brother named Averian, who was a bard, and he sang a song to the island of Ireland, asking that they be allowed to land, and the winds quieted. When the Sons of Meal got to Ireland, they defeated the Tuatha in battle, and they fled over the sea, though some versions of the story say that they were exiled below the ground, and thus this is the origin of the fairy mounds. The Sons of Meal then divided Ireland into two halves. Erevon the Elder got the northern half, and Ever got the south. And thus they are the ancestors of two major ruling dynasties of Ireland in north and south. Everyone in Ireland is thus a descendant, either of the Sons of Meal or of the people they conquered. And I'm happy to say that with the arrival of the Sons of Meal, the Gaels, we've actually peopled Ireland at last. And this is what the Irish believed about how their island was peopled down through the Middle Ages and beyond. But starting as early as the 16th century, scholars in other countries, especially England, began to cast some doubt upon this story. We have arrived now at the second moment I want to talk about, the era of modern scholarship. Skeptical English scholars started to raise concerns about all of these giants and magic mists and so forth. It gradually dawned on most people, even the Irish themselves, that the stories in the Book of Invasions could not be literally true in every detail. But what if these stories preserved a kernel of truth? What if they at least represented actual traditions that had been handed down from the immemorial Celtic past? Here we come back to the debate I mentioned at the beginning about the way in which we use Irish sources written down after the Irish converted to Christianity. The older view of this question is that you could actually trust these sources very much. There's a very famous formulation by the great historian and linguist Kenneth Hurlstone Jackson, who wrote an article in 1964 that claimed that early Irish texts could be read as if they opened up a window on the Iron Age. Scholars like Jackson became known as the nativist school, because they believed that what you see in early Irish texts is a fairly pure representation of authentic Irish tradition. They argued that Irish literature was essentially conservative, and that it had preserved an unbroken link to the remote pagan past, all the way back to a common Celtic culture, and even to a common Indo-European culture many thousands of years ago. The nativist argument rested on two main theories. The first theory is that there did indeed exist, at one time, a common Indo-European culture that spread all over Europe with the spread of Indo-European languages, of which Celtic is, of course, a major subgroup, and then a common Celtic culture, of which the Irish language is a major constituent. The second theory is that such a culture could genuinely be preserved over very long periods by oral transmission. But the nativists needed a way to explain how such texts could really preserve material from thousands of years ago. The breakthrough came in the late 1950s and early 1960s from work done by Albert Lord and Dennis Page on the way oral traditions are preserved. Lord and Page argued from their studies of the Iliad and other Greek texts that oral tradition could preserve a record of archaic society and remain unchanged when it was finally written down. They thought the Iliad probably did represent a work first composed in the remote past and handed down orally for many centuries until it was finally committed to writing. Now, this theory gave a lot of hope to scholars of Ireland like Jackson, who really wanted to use these post-conversion sources to create a picture of early Irish society. Jackson claimed in 1964 that the Irish texts are very archaic in appearance, very circumstantial, and on the whole, very consistent, and that they belong to a period some centuries older than the time when they were first written down, belong, in fact, to a prehistoric Ireland. So here is the warrant for using early texts as a window on the Iron Age. But even if you accept that the texts do represent the survival of an ancient tradition, there's another big question you need to ask, namely, why Christian scholars in the period after the conversion would have taken the trouble to preserve all of this pagan material? I mean, magic mists? One-eyed giants? The fact that everything seems to come in multiples of three, 3 ships, 30 men, 300 years, etc., and I could go on, there has to be some explanation for recording all of this patently un-Christian behavior. The nativists came up with a theory that can never be proven completely from the evidence, but you can see what you think. They argued that the early Irish scholars, Christians though they were, had a deep respect for and love of their heritage, and that they wanted to preserve it before it was lost. The nativists imagined the early scholars as heritage buffs, who were not especially troubled by the pagan stuff they were recording. It was their native history, after all. The nativists do concede, reluctantly it seems, that the texts show a few signs of monastic censorship. Characters who were obviously originally gods or goddesses are sometimes depicted as mere human beings, like the Tuatha De Danann. But they're willing to overlook these few lapses and cling gratefully to the mass of authentic material that the texts preserve. Now, we'll never be able to get completely inside the minds of the people who recorded these texts. But I think it's rather touching that modern scholars have imagined these ancient scholars to be rather a lot like them. So nativists might proceed from the assumption that maybe these texts represent memories of an actual series of migrations to Ireland that correspond to major changes in technology. They have even tried to make connections between the archaeological evidence for different layers of cultural influence and the different peoples in the story. Maybe the Fir Bolg represent the first Neolithic farmers, for example. Maybe the Tuatha De Danann are the first people who could work metal. What about the Celts? You may remember that I talked in an earlier lecture about how 19th century scholars conceived of the Celts as originating in Central Europe and spreading outward by conquest. They supposedly arrived in Britain and Ireland as invaders in either one wave or two waves, depending on the theory. Doesn't this sound an awful lot like the Book of Invasions? Of course, the Celtic origin theory has the Celts coming from Central Europe, not Spain. But perhaps there is even an explanation for the otherwise odd-seeming Spanish connection. There is, in fact, a region in northwest Spain known as Galicia that has Celtic roots. The name is etymologically related to the word Gaelic. Perhaps, many scholars have argued, the story of the Sons of Meal represents the memory of a real migration from Spain by people of Gaelic speech. I will have more to say about Galicia in a future lecture. So what you see here is that scholars up through the mid-20th century were trying to figure out ways to harmonize the Book of Invasions with their ideas of how the Celts spread out from Hallstatt and Latenn, or possibly even from Galicia. The nativist view is thus a very optimistic view of how we can use these Irish texts in combination with modern scholarship to paint a picture of how Ireland came to be a Celtic nation. But now we come to the third moment at which I want to examine the question of how Ireland was peopled. Since the 1990s, the pendulum has swung in a more pessimistic direction with regard to how much we can use these texts to tell us what pre-Christian Irish traditions actually were. More recent scholars, such as Kim McCone, have done a lot of textual analysis, and they are much more skeptical than earlier scholars, like Kenneth Jackson, about the notion that these texts preserve the pure pre-Christian past. For one thing, they have found a lot more Christian stuff in these texts than the earlier scholars did. The narratives have often been shaped to conform to biblical models. And in short, we clearly cannot read them as unself-conscious records of the pre-Christian past. They're not even intended to be that. So you've got deliberate distortions being inserted to suit the ideology of the scribes recording the stories. To take the Book of Invasions as an example, we have a basic fact that strikes every reader of the text. The narrative has been harmonized with the chronology of the Bible. We have Noah, we have Moses and Pharaoh, etc. We basically have the Irish wandering around like a 13th tribe of Israel. So clearly, if these are ancient native traditions, they have been wedged into an explicitly Christian worldview. Furthermore, the Bible is not the only non-Irish text that has influenced the Book of Invasions. Remember the mermaids and the need to put wax in your ears to resist their siren call? That is straight out of the Odyssey. So these texts really represent a mishmash of native traditions and Christian and classical influences. And the task of disentangling these elements to recover a pure lost original is probably hopeless. Furthermore, as if that were not worrisome enough, new doubt has been cast on the idea of oral transmission as an inherently conservative process. New work on living oral traditions in Africa has shown that they are more dynamic than people used to think. Modern concerns end up creeping into ancient stories. There are apparently some sub-Saharan African stories that are supposed to take place hundreds of years ago, where people are reported to be using very modern weapons. So maybe we can't be sure the Irish stories go back unchanged to the Iron Age, let alone the remote Indo-European past. The most recent scholarship doubts seriously whether we can make any actual correlations between the stories and the prehistoric past, and they say further that the medieval Irish people who wrote the legends down weren't trying to do that either. They were trying to create a blend of old traditions and new traditions. They wanted the Irish to have a connection to the classical past. But this means that we don't really know what pre-Christian Irish people thought about their past, and we certainly can't use these stories as a guide to what really happened. Furthermore, we have the two kinds of non-written evidence I mentioned at the beginning, archaeological evidence and DNA analysis, and neither kind of evidence supports the idea of Ireland being peopled by a series of invasions. Archaeological evidence does not show signs of a large-scale movement of peoples into Ireland at the time of the supposed Celtic migrations in the 3rd century or so BC. But it's very interesting to see that while DNA evidence does not show strong correlations between the inhabitants of Ireland and the inhabitants of Central Europe, it does show links between the Irish and the inhabitants of the whole European Atlantic seaboard, including Spain. I'll say more about DNA evidence in a later lecture, but for now, I will leave you with the intriguing possibility that the authors of the Book of Invasions may have accidentally been right.
Lecture 10, Celtic Britain After Rome.
Welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to return to a topic from a previous lecture and focus on what happened to the Celtic-speaking regions of Britain after the withdrawal of the Roman legions. It used to be thought that Roman Britain was destroyed by Germanic invaders, the famous Angles and Saxons and Jutes that English schoolchildren used to learn about. Supposedly, these invaders exterminated the local Romanized but Celtic-speaking population. According to the traditional narrative, Celtic-speaking Britons were progressively pushed westwards by the advance of the newcomers. The result was that the island of Britain was divided into an English-speaking England in the south and east, with a fringe of Celtic speakers in the southwest, west, and northwest. That's the traditional story, and it's the one I learned in school. But it turns out that the story is a lot more complicated and a lot more interesting. The retreat of Celtic speech and culture may have actually been due much more to assimilation than to invasion. I'll say more about this hypothesis later, but let me first lay out what I want to cover in this lecture. I'm going to talk about the beginnings of what later became known as the Celtic Fringe, because the Celtic languages survived on the western coast of the island of Britain, like a fringe all around the English-speaking areas. As English spread from east to west, pockets of Celtic speakers became increasingly isolated from one another in three main areas: the northwest, in what is now northwestern England and southeastern Scotland, the west, in what is now Wales, and the southwest, in what is now Cornwall. I'll be talking much more about Wales in a later lecture, so in this lecture, I will concentrate on the northwest and the southwest. Let's back up to the Roman period. The height of Roman rule in Britain was the 2nd century. We see very prosperous villas in the countryside, and the cities were flourishing as well. Life in Britain carried on fairly well, but starting in the 3rd century, Britain began to be attacked by barbarians. This was a crisis that affected not just Britain, but really the whole of the Roman Empire in the 3rd century. Britain had its own localized barbarian problem. It got hit from two directions. From the west, there were raiders from Ireland. These people were known, confusingly for us, as the Scotti. And this is because, as we have seen, some of them would later settle in Scotland and give their name to that country. But anyway, there are these raiders from Ireland, and then there are also raiders from the northwest coast of Europe, raiders from Germanic-speaking tribes in what are now the Low Countries and northern Germany. They mostly came to Britain on smash-and-grab type raids. They were looking for booty, and especially for slaves. The Romans counteracted this threat by appointing a commander to defend the southeast coast. He was known as the Count of the Saxon Shore. It's a bad sign when you name a part of your territory after the people who are raiding it. In 367 AD, Britain was hit by a perfect storm of barbarian raiders. This episode is known as the Barbarian Conspiracy. That's what it was actually called by a contemporary Roman writer named Ammianus Marcellinus. What seems to have happened is that somehow the Irish to the west and the Picts to the north got together to attack Britain. At the same time, the coast of Gaul was being hit by Germanic raiders, so the Roman authorities there couldn't help. The Count of the Saxon Shore was killed, and all seemed lost until a large Roman army showed up under the future Roman Emperor Theodosius, and they saved the day. The same scenario was repeated a few years later, and the Roman general Stilicho had to come and help. But that kind of rescue was never going to be available to Roman Britain again. And that's because things were steadily getting worse for Rome. And we are headed inexorably towards the fall of Rome. In 406 AD, there was an unusually cold winter, and the Rhine River froze. Large numbers of barbarians from northern Europe simply walked across the river into Roman territory and raided all over the Roman province of Gaul. This was a threat to the security of Rome itself, so Emperor Honorius decided on a fateful step. He ordered the Roman legions in Britain to withdraw to the continent, and he told the residents of Britain, essentially, you're on your own. What happened next? This is where the picture gets murky. The traditional picture of the 5th century is that you get barbarian invasions. Without the Roman troops there to defend the province, the way lies clear for large-scale raiding. And we have a rather poignant record of the reaction of the local population to this alarming turn of events. This is preserved in a work by an author from the 6th century named Gildas, and I'll say more about Gildas in a moment. But he records a very plaintive request for help that the authorities in Britain sent to a Roman commander in Gaul in the middle of the 5th century. The letter reads, "The barbarians push us back to the sea. The sea pushes us back to the barbarians. Between these two kinds of death, we are either drowned or slaughtered." And Gildas notes that Britain got no help in return. So this is very much the story that later written sources tell us. But there is a problem. The archaeological remains from the 5th century do not show much evidence of warfare. They suggest that what you see is not an invasion in the sense of armed bands imposing themselves on an unwilling population. Instead, you see a rather peaceful infiltration. And that is because in the 5th century, the nature of the barbarian problem changed. Up until now, mostly the barbarians had been raiding. They would come, grab what they wanted, maybe burn the rest, kill some people, and then leave. But starting in the mid-5th century, they started staying. You start to see permanent settlements in Britain, especially in the south and east. Now, there's currently some controversy among historians about this process. It used to be thought that these settlers imposed their will by force, that they were conquerors. More recently, some archaeological work has suggested that the process of Germanic settlement in Britain was a gradual one, and it involved assimilation more than violence. But whether it was violent or peaceful or something in between, the new settlers put down permanent roots in Britain. They seem to have settled in rather small bands, perhaps no more than a few dozen people at a time. These people probably brought their women and children with them, either when they first came or later on. But there is also evidence in the DNA of contemporary British cemeteries that there was considerable intermarriage with the native population. The process of assimilation seems to have taken place over several generations. Certainly, some of the British inhabitants, probably especially the elites, did move west and north and southwest into the later Celtic fringe. As far as we can tell, though, many of the British just blended in with the new culture the settlers brought with them. Over time, they adopted the speech of the newcomers, and this is why there is almost no trace left of the British language in modern English. The British simply stopped speaking British and started speaking the language that ultimately became English. There does seem to have been a long period of bilingualism, though, because there are many English place names that are clearly translations of British ones, or they might be double names. For example, Breedon in Leicestershire is made up of the British word for hill, brae, and the English word for hill, dun. So the name Breedon literally means hill, hill. In a way, the name of this place is a record of the period when the assimilation between the British and the English was going on. But ultimately, English won out, not British. And this is a sign of the kind of cultural attractiveness or military dominance or probably a little bit of both that the new settlers were able to exert on the British. Incidentally, since modern speakers of English no longer remember that dun means hill, the town is now referred to as Breedon on the Hill, which effectively translates as Hill Hill on the Hill. But this assimilation, important as it was only part of the story. In the late 5th and early 6th centuries, there may have been some sort of concerted effort to push back against the new settlers. I mentioned Gildas before, the 6th century writer who recorded that pathetic cry for help to the Roman authorities. Gildas was a British writer, a Christian, who wrote about the history of Britain during the period of barbarian settlement. He says that at the end of the 5th century, a great war leader emerged who fought 12 great battles against the barbarians. The last of these battles, at Mount Badon, was a great victory that halted the advance of the barbarians for 50 years. That is, right up to the time when Gildas was writing, when things were obviously getting bad again. This statement by Gildas seems to be the earliest evidence we have for the existence of the figure who later became known as King Arthur. It's not a lot to go on. Gildas calls this person a war leader, not a king. And in fact, the way he talks about him makes it clear that there are other people who are kings, and that this guy isn't one of them. And he doesn't give him the name Arthur, or in fact any other name. We first get the name Arthur in the early 7th century poem about southern Scotland called the Gododin, and here he isn't called a king either. He is simply mentioned as a warrior that other warriors should be compared to. And we don't even know where Mount Badon was, though lots of people have tried to figure it out. A 9th century writer named Nennius said that Arthur fought 12 battles, but we aren't sure where they were. Still, there is some evidence in the archaeological record that there was indeed a 50-year halt in the advance of Germanic settlement in Britain. On the borders of the southeastern kingdom of Kent, Saxon pottery went out of use for a time. So perhaps we have some confirmation here of the essential truth of the story. Could that halt have been caused by this war leader, who may or may not have been called Arthur? Let's review the evidence and assess the arguments. The facts as we know them could support the idea of a famous war leader, not a king, who stemmed the tide of the Germanic advance in Britain. Maybe he was even named Arthur, but there are some important cautions to keep in mind. We cannot be sure that the person Gildas describes and the person mentioned in the poem about the Gododin are the same. We don't have any evidence about that, one way or the other. It may be that Nennius had good reason to think they were the same, but he may just have put the two texts side by side and made a great big assumption, which people down to the present day have been making ever since. We also can't be sure that the pause in settlement that we seem to see in the archaeological record was caused by the activity of the war leader that Gildas mentions. There are plenty of other factors that could have caused a temporary halt in migration. Changes in the political situation back on the continent, maybe? A lack of leadership? Any number of other causes. And again, the archaeological record doesn't really support an idea of large-scale military activity at this time. We don't have 12 battlefields to go with Nennius's 12 battles. So I think we need to keep an open mind about Arthur. We don't know if he really existed, or if he did, if he was actually called Arthur. But I think there are two main things we need to take away from this question of whether or not Arthur was real. The first is that the story of the leader Gildas describes does capture a real phenomenon. The British were retreating, at least in terms of their language and culture and political authority. And the Germanic settlers were advancing, whether this was due to assimilation or to military conquest. So the poignant part of the Arthur story, that this is one brief shining moment and that it will fade into darkness, that is there from the beginning. The second important point, of course, is that we're well on our way to a legend. The story of Arthur had quite a future, and he would later become a Celtic hero who was also adopted by the English. So he was, in fact, a crossover hit. But let's get back to the consequences of the developments we've been talking about in the 5th and 6th centuries. The progressive anglicization of eastern Britain led to the areas of Celtic speech becoming more and more isolated from each other. We'll look at two areas where British speech survived for a time, the far north and Cornwall. And we'll leave Wales, the only area where a Celtic language has survived continuously to the present, to another lecture. Let's start with Cornwall. If you look at a map, you can see that it's one of the smaller Celtic areas. It's geographically just about as isolated as you can get without being an island, since it's on a peninsula at the far southwest of Britain, almost completely cut off from England by the Tamar River. This isolation is something that is the stuff of jokes today. A few years ago, there were massive floods in Cornwall, and a Cornish MP got up in the House of Commons and said, "The floods were terrible. England was completely cut off." Well, there's a lot in that joke, but it demonstrates how real the geographic factor is in determining Cornish identity. So how did Cornwall get so isolated? Let's go all the way back to what was going on in this part of the island of Britain when the Romans invaded in the 1st century AD. The most important tribe in this area